ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। मयि निर्बद्धहृदयः साधव समदर्शनः वशे कुर्वन्ति मां भक्त्या सत्स्त्रिया सत्पतिं यथा। मयि निर्बद्धहृदयः साधव समदर्शनः वशे कुर्वन्ति मां भक्त्या सत्स्त्रिया सत्पतिं यथा। मयि अन्टु मी निर्बद्धहृदयः firmly attached in the core of the heart, sadhavah, the pure devotees, samadarshanah, who are equal to everyone, vashe, under control, kurvanti, they make, maam, unto me, bhaktya, by devotional service. Satstriyaha, chaste woman. Satpatim, unto the gentle husband. Yatha, as. Bad. Translation. As chaste women bring their gentle husbands under control by service, the pure devotees who are equal to everyone and completely attached to me in the core of the heart, bring me under their full control. Purport. In this verse, the word samdarshanaha is significant. The pure devotee is actually equal toward everyone. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 18:54, Brahma bhuta prasannatma na shochati na kaankshati samah sarveshu bhuteshu. Universal brotherhood is possible when one is a pure devotee, panditaha samadarshanaha. A pure devotee is actually learned because he knows his constitutional position. He knows the position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he knows the relationship between the living entity and the Supreme Lord. Thus he has full spiritual knowledge and is automatically liberated, brahma bhutaha. He can therefore see everyone on the spiritual platform. He can comprehend the happiness and distress of all living entities. He understands that what is happiness to him is also happiness to others, and that what is distress to him is distressing for others. Therefore, he is sympathetic to everyone. As Prahlad Maharaj said, शोचे ततो विमुख चेतस इंद्रियार्थान माया सुखाय भरमुद्वहतो विमूढान. भागवतम 7.9.43. पीपल सफर फ्रॉम मटीरियल डिस्ट्रेस बिकॉज दे आर नॉट अटैच्ड टू द सुप्रीम पर्सनैलिटी ऑफ गॉडहेड. अ प्योर डिवोटी'स चीफ कंसर्न देयरफॉर इज टू रेज द इग्नोरेंट मास ऑफ पीपल टू द सेंस ऑफ कृष्णा कॉन्शियसनेस. That I can try to speak something worthwhile for the glorification of the Lord and for the purification of my own filthy heart. Hare Krishna. So, this series of verses, we started two verses before, is expressing the heart of the Supreme Lord. And we see that the heart of the Lord is filled with love for his devotees. In fact, literally also the Lord will say a couple of verses later, Sadhavam hrudayam mayam, sadhanam hrudayam tadam, madanyatte na janati, naham tebhyo manamagapi. That I am in my devotee's heart and the devotees are in my heart. I know nobody except them and they know nobody except me. So, the background is that Durvasa Muni, having tried to attack and assassinate Ambarish Maharaj, has had to flee for the life, for his own life instead, because Sudarshan not only destroyed the demon that he had created but also started chasing him. And after going to Brahma and Shiva, finally has come to Lord Vishnu's lotus feet and is begging him, please save me. And Lord Vishnu will tell later that I cannot save you. The only person who can save you is the devotee whom you have offended. I am powerless. So Srimad Bhagavatam actually is, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu called it the Amala Puran. And the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is like the heart of Srimad Bhagavatam. And not only the heart, it is also the large part of the Srimad Bhagavatam. There are 335 chapters in the Srimad Bhagavatam, out of which 90 chapters are in the 10th canto. And the 10th canto is almost like one third, 33% of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So by the time Parikshit Maharaj, Shukadeva Goswami comes to the 10th canto, although 9 cantos are over, it's only 2.5-3 days over. So 3.5-4 days over. And 11th canto and the 3rd canto are the other two big cantos, around 35 chapters are there in each of them. So before taking us to the 10th canto, Shukadeva Goswami is actually systematically, not chronologically, but systematically. Chronologically means we'll be going as per time. This happened this time, this happened this time. That actually the mundane history is just a list of names of dead successful people. People who were successful at one time, then they died and went away. Shukadeva Goswami is not concerned with that sort of history. He's concerned with history of those personalities who transcended death. And so he's describing events from different epochs, different millennia, different universes, to teach the principles that will enable us to transcend the cycle of birth and death. So till he comes to the 10th canto, he does two things. First is establish the position of Krishna, and second is establish the position of bhakti. So the position of the first 9 cantos talk about Vishnu. In between they talk about Krishna also, repeatedly. In Ambarish Maharaj pastime also, we have Savai Manha Krishna Padaravindayor. And the focus goes entirely on Krishna in the 10th canto. But also along with establishing Vishnu and Krishna's position, the Bhagavatam is also establishing the position of bhakti. To some extent, Krishna does this in the Gita also. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita talks about different paths. He talks about karma, jnana, yoga. But after talking about all these paths, he establishes how all these paths ultimately culminate in bhakti. So he talks about yoga in the 6th chapter, Dhyana Yoga, and he says, Yoginam pi sarvesha madgatina antaratmana. In fact, it's not just in 6.47. Throughout, in 6.15, 6.30, Yomam pashyati sarvatra, sarvam chami pashyati. Krishna says how he is the ultimate goal of yoga and bhakti to him is the culmination of yoga. Similarly, Krishna talks about how jnana culminates in bhakti. Bahunam janmanamante jnanavan mam prapadite. 7.19 he talks about that. And even about how karma culminates in bhakti, he talks about that in the 3rd chapter. Yajnarthat karmano netra lokoyam karma bandhana. So here in this 3.9, if somebody says this is a little ambiguous, who yajna refers to? Then at the end of the chapter of Karma Yoga 3.30, again he says that Mai Sarvani Karmani Sanyasya Adhyatma Chetasa Nirashir Nirmama Bhutva Yudhya Swamikata Jvara. So again he says that if Yajna is not clear, it's Mai, unto me you have to surrender. So Yajna, Karma and Jnana, sorry, Karma, Jnana, Yoga and Karma. These three are the different paths which are there. And Krishna shows in the Bhagavad Gita how all of them culminate in bhakti. And Bhagavatam demonstrates that. So this particular pastime demonstrates how a bhakta is far, far superior to a yogi. Durvasa Muni is a very powerful yogi. But a bhakta is far more superior to yogi. The path of karma, karma means karma kanda, that culminates in going to heavens for sense enjoyment. And the what happens by karma kanda is demonstrated in the fourth canto through the pastime of Prachinipari. He is doing so many yajnas, but he is himself getting entangled and he will have to suffer. So that somebody may say that is because he didn't do the karmakanda yajnas properly. But even if somebody does the karmakanda yajnas properly and he succeeds in becoming Indra, but what happens to Indra is demonstrated throughout the Bhagavatam. Sixth canto, eighth canto, he's always getting into trouble. Similarly, what about Gyan? Gyan, the Bhagavatam starts itself with Shukadeva Goswami, who had attained the perfection of jnana, Atma Ramascha Munayo Nirgrantha Apyurukrame Kurvantya Hitukim Bhakti Ittham Bhuta Gunohari. So, even the Atma Ramas who are not attracted to anything material are attracted to Krishna. So, the path of jnana culminates in bhakti. And there also in the Bhagavatam, again in the fourth canto, there is example of the Kumaras. Kinjal Kamishra Sanj. So, makarandavayo, that when the sankshobham aksharujasham apichitta tanvoho, that they don't get agitated by anything material, those who are fixed in the path of jnana, but they were agitated when they got the fragrance of the tulsi leaves that were adorning the lotus feet of the Lord. So in this way, karma, jnana and yoga, all of them culminate in bhakti. In fact, bhakti is so powerful that bhakti inverts the normal hierarchy. The normal hierarchy is that the devatas are superior and the asuras are inferior. But in the sixth canto and in the eighth canto, we see that there is a devata Indra and there is the asura Vritrasur. Or there is a devata Indra and there is the asura Bali. But both of them are actually shown to be more glorious. Although they were born in a demoniac family, still they are shown to be higher. And in fact, the sixth and the eighth cantos talk about how there was a conflict and apparently the devata won, but it was the asura who won. But the seventh canto takes it even further, and somebody who is born in a demoniac family and he has a demoniac father, and that father has actually defeated everyone else, including all the devatas. But his son becomes a devotee and he's such an exalted devotee, the Lord personally appears for him. So the normal Vedic hierarchy of the devatas being higher than the asuras is inverted when there is a bhakti in asura. And that's repeatedly demonstrated. 6th, 7th, 8th canto are demonstrating that. Now this canto is another demonstrating another hierarchy. Normally somebody who is a sannyasi is considered to be higher than a grahastha. But here, Durvasa Muni is a sannyasi and Ambarish Maharaj is a grahastha. But again that hierarchy is inverted. Why? Because Ambarish Maharaj is a devotee. So in this way, systematically, the Bhagavatam is establishing the position, the supreme position of bhakti. That either we take it among the various paths of karma, jnana, yoga, or even the normal progression of the different ashramas or the different levels in the cosmic hierarchy. If somebody has bhakti, then he goes way above everyone else. So this is what is demonstrated here in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the Srimad Bhagavatam will lead on. Now, this particular canto is also the fall of another yogi, Shobhari. He's also a powerful yogi. So these two are very powerful, another, lust and pride. So pride and anger, because of pride, anger came in Durvasa. That is demonstrated through one yogi and Shobhari Muni. The pitfall of lust is demonstrated. And after, in this way, systematically demonstrating the supremacy of bhakti, then Shukadeva Goswami is going to lead on to the paramount bhaktas, the topmost bhaktas, that is the Vrajavasis. So the Bhagavatam is actually essentially talking about Krishna. It talks about Krishna right in the beginning. Just like sometimes when we have a movie is to be released, then they give a brief trailer of the movie. So like that, in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, from chapters 7 onwards, they give a trailer of the 10th canto pastimes. There is Krishna. Suddenly, because if you see, there is conversation with Vyasa and Narada going on, and suddenly this chapter comes along, the son of Drona punished. And then the Bhagavatam pastime goes on, and Krishna's pastimes are there, and Krishna enters as the charioteer of Arjuna, the same way he has entered in Bhagavad Gita. And then it carries on till the disappearance of Krishna and the cursing of Parikshit, and then the Bhagavatam storyline starts. So what is going to come in the 10th canto, that is described as a preview in the first canto, to attract the readers, the hearers, till to persevere till the 10th canto. And the Bhagavatam says, in the invocatory verses only, Muhur aho rasika bhuvi bhavukaha. Rasika. Rasika, those who are relishers of mellows, they can relish these pastimes. So this rasa is a very commonly used word in Srila Prabhupada's purports. But rasa is actually a unique contribution of the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition to the understanding of bhakti. So before we come to that, let's take a little historical background. Today is the appearance day of Madhvacharya. So we can talk a little bit about him also. You know, Shankaracharya was sent by the Lord, as described in the Padma Puran, to drive out Mayavadamasachastram prasannam pachammam bauddham uchyate. So he came and drew out Buddhism. And he gave a seemingly religious excuse for people to not surrender to God. Those who want to pretend to be religious but don't want to surrender to God. For them, he gave impersonalism. And subsequently, the Vaishnava Acharyas, Ramanujacharya came in around 11th century, 1017 to around 1137 he was there. Shankaracharya was around 726. So after 300 years he came, Ramanujacharya refuted Shankaracharya quite well. So basically what Ramanujacharya did was, he took the same scriptures which Shankaracharya had taken. Shankaracharya took Vishnu Puran, Ramanujacharya also took Vishnu Puran. And he took the same scriptures and refuted Shankaracharya. But about 100 years after that, Madhvacharya appeared. And Madhvacharya, because Shankaracharya's hold on the Hindu thought was very great. It is actually stronger than the hold of modern science, or Western science on modern thought today. So it had to be gradually done. So Madhvacharya came and he launched an all-out attack. He took the scriptures with Rama, which Shankaracharya had used, and he used them and refuted, and he took several other scriptures. An all-out attack. And he talked about, so Shankaracharya said, everything is one. At ekam brahma dvitiya nasti. So Ramanujacharya said, yeah, everything is one, but there is a difference. Actually, it's Vishishtadvaita, that is philosophy. So Ramanujacharya's defining analogy was that every sampradaya has its defining analogy, which in a nutshell tells what is the philosophy of that sampradaya. So Ramanujacharya's defining analogy was the soul and the body. So the soul is Vishnu and the body is Prakriti and Jiva. So now this is in one sense true because Mahavishnu enters into the Pradhan. And Mahavishnu is the super soul of the whole universe. So he says, yes, just as the soul is the same as the body and is different from the body. In a conventional sense we talk about it, we don't always differentiate how are you, that is how is your body and how is your soul. You don't talk about it like that. So wherever the scriptures do talk about Brahman and Jiva as the same, we have to understand it's being talked in a conventional way. That was the analogy that he used. So he said, yes, there is oneness and there is difference also. But Madhvacharya, he came and launched an all-out attack. He said, there is no oneness at all. Everything is dvaita. Actually, all the Upanishads talk about tattvatraya. Tattvatraya means three truths. There is Jiva, Ishvara and Prakriti. So taking this tattvatraya, Madhvacharya talked about the pancham bheda. Five differences. He said there is a difference between Jiva and Ishvara. There is difference between Prakriti and Ishvara. There is difference between Prakriti and Prakriti. There is difference between Jiva and Jiva. And there is difference between Jiva and Prakriti. So So there is no question of any oneness. There is duality everywhere. That's why we see Madhvacharya. Two fingers is Dvaitavad. So, Dvaita, there is no oneness. There is actually two-ness. Duality is there. So, in our Sampradaya, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took two things from the Madhvacharya's teachings. And one of them was Mayavad Dushan. Refutation of Mayavad. And one of the significant ways Madhvacharya refuted Mayavad was talking about the concept of Vishesha. Vishesha means inherent characteristic. Like we have in Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschyatya Deshatarini. So what is this Nirvishesha? So generally the polemic means between the debate between the personalist and the impersonalist, would go on, is God Sagud or is he Nirgud? But there are so many references in the scripture to the fact that the absolute truth is Nirgun. Now, the word Nirgun has two meanings. One is, the word Guna can mean qualities, and the word Guna can also mean modes. So, when the scriptures say that the Lord is Nirgun, that means he is not affected by the material modes. That does not mean that he has no qualities. So, therefore, Madhvacharya redefined the terminology, and he said instead of using Nirgun and Sagun, we should use Nirvishesh and Savishesh. So what is Nirvishesh and Savishesh? That he talked about the Mayavadis may also sometimes worship deities, they may also sing songs, and they may also do the activity that bhaktas do. But their idea is what? Like there's a famous Mayavadi teacher, he says that you should meditate on your Ishtadev. Ishtadev. Choose whichever God you want to meditate. They think they're very broad-minded. We are having democracy. You can elect whoever you want. But according to them, spirituality is such a democracy that you don't need a majority. Your own vote is the majority. You can choose your own God and worship that. So you meditate on your deity and you concentrate and concentrate and concentrate. And the success of your dhyana, the success of your meditation is when by the power of your concentration, the deity crumbles into powder. So demoniac. So that means then by your concentration, you have gone beyond form to the formless light. So actually the Muslims came and destroyed temples and desecrated deities physically. But the impersonalists, they come and desecrate the deities intellectually. Philosophically. They may accept the deities temporarily, but they want to go beyond the deities. So their idea is what? That for God, even if he has a form, that form is an acquired quality. So acquired quality means what? Like this seat is here. The seat is acquired by painting a particular color. Now that color is external to it. It was given to it at a particular time and it can be removed from it. So like that, they say that God has a form which is given to him by our own mental conception. So we are the creators of God. We are the creators of God. So God has a form given to us by our mental conception and that is external to him. And when we become advanced enough, we take away that form and we go beyond the form. So that is an acquired quality. But what is the inherent quality? Like there is a rose which is red in color. Now the redness of the rose cannot be separated from the rose. From its very existence, the rose is always red. So this is an inherent quality. So an inherent quality is called as Vishesha. So actually, Madhvacharya talked extensively about this and Balde Vidya Bhushan in his Govinda Bhashya as well as Gita Bhushan, he takes this concept mainly from the teachings of Madhvacharya. That the proper, that the Nama, Rupa, Guna, Leela are the Lord's inherent qualities, not his acquired qualities. Not the qualities which you have given to him by some mental conception. There is inherent qualities. And those who say that God is actually ultimately Nirvishesh, Prabhupada, Nirvishesh Unyadi, Paschyatya Deshatarane. Prabhupada has come to save us from them. So, Madhvacharya actually refuted impersonalism in a very powerful way and he established, you know, the Udupi Krishna temple he established and he gave a tremendous boost to the spreading of bhakti all over and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came later and fulfilled the long time master plan which was there, multi-century master plan. So Madhvacharya is himself Hanumanji and Bhima, extremely powerful. And physically also he was powerful, intellectually also he was powerful. So at one time the impersonalists, they found that he's just too powerful to debate with. So then they send a bodybuilder. They said, oh, you were a wrestler earlier, I want to wrestle with you. So Madhvacharya said, I have given up wrestling now. He says, oh, that means you are a coward. He said, no. So Madhvacharya said, okay, if you want to wrestle with me, first, you move my toe. He put his leg forward, move my toe. If you can move my toe, then I will accept that you are worthy of fighting with me. So that wrestler felt very insulted. And he thought, I'll just take his leg and pull him down and knock him and beat him to death. So he took his leg and was trying to move it. And he was tugging and shaking and panting and ranting and cursing, and he was not able to do anything. And he started sweating. And he was wiping off the sweat and again holding the leg. And more sweat was coming. He was again wiping off the sweat. And again he was trying to hold it. And Madhvacharya was just meditating on the Supreme Lord. And what was happening? This wrestler was taking the dust of Madhvacharya's feet on his head. And eventually, not only was he physically defeated, but he was spiritually purified. And he fell at the feet of Madhvacharya, not just physically, but even spiritually, and became his disciple afterwards. So, Madhvacharya Bhagavat Pad Ki Jai. So, after Madhvacharya, we had Chaitanya Mahaprabhu coming, and he synthesized the Advaita and Advaita by talking about Achintya Bheda Bheda, the simultaneous oneness and difference. And Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is written by Srila Rupa Goswami, talked about the absolute truth in terms of rasa. Now rasa, before coming to Krishna consciousness, you know, probably we heard of rasa only in amras. You know, mango juice. That's our idea of rasa. So, what exactly is this rasa? Bharat Muni has written the Natya Shastra. And in Natya Shastra is described how the devatas once went to Brahmaji and told that we would like to have a form of entertainment that will be simultaneously uplifting as well as entertaining. That will involve all the senses and engage all the talents that people have. And then at that time, Brahmaji instructed the devatas in the Natya Shastra. So in the Natya Shastra, the concept is that when certain actors dressed in a particular way, they do certain gestures and speak certain expressions in particular ways, that background, that setting, those expressions, they create certain emotions in the audience. So the emotions that are created by a proper dramatic setting and a dramatic performance is called as rasa. So depending on how expert, firstly, the actors are, and how rasik the audience is. Even the audience has to be cultured to be able to experience the emotions. But when the audience is cultured and the actors are expert, then certain rasas are experienced. Certain emotions are experienced. So the Natya Shastra of Bharat Muni mainly talks about rasa as an emotion that is occasionally experienced when there is a good dramatic performance. Now Rupa Goswami took the basic theory which Bharat Muni had given, and he went forward and explained that for a devotee, rasa is not just an occasional emotion experienced by a dramatic performance. It is a constant fact of life. And the Natya Shastra is not necessarily devotional. There can be, generally, most of the dramas in Vedic culture were devotional, but they're not necessarily devotional. But Rupa Goswami explained that rasa is an emotion that a devotee experiences constantly in relationship with the Supreme Lord. So, for us, as rasa has different meanings. Like we have those five rasas, which are the sthayi bhav, the constant relationship. So, sakhya, vatsalya, madhurya, These are constant relationships. This is the predominant steady emotion within any relationship. And beyond that also, there are the secondary rasas. So these secondary rasas like bibhatsa or bhayanaka or hasya, they embellish the relationship, the primary relationship which is in the particular rasa. So for example, when Yashoda Mai, her predominant rasa is in Vatsalya. She thinks that she is the protector of Krishna. But when Trunavart comes and takes Krishna away and she's blinded, and when she gets back her vision, she says Krishna is not there anymore. She's overpowered, horrified. So at that time, that rasa of Vatsalya is embellished, is enhanced by the rasa of Bibhatsa. So rasa means first a predominant relationship, and within that predominant relationship, there are emotions. So rasa means relationship as well as emotions within the relationship. So the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu talks about the different emotions that a devotee experiences in the relationships with the Supreme Lord. And those same relationships which are talked about Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu are elaborated by Rupa Goswami further in the Ujjwala Neelamani, where he focuses exclusively on the Madhurya Rasa relationships, the relationship between Krishna and the gopis. So this concept of rasa. Rasa means it's the analysis of emotions to show how emotions can be related to the Supreme Lord is very beautifully explained in our Sampradaya. In fact, in the Ramayana, today is also Dasara. So in the Ramayana, when the Lord Ram and Lakshman are in the forest, they have just come to Chitrakoot. At that time, and they just hear a loud noise and they see birds flying in the sky. And Lord Rama asks Lakshman, what is happening? Please climb up a tree and see. Lakshman climbs up and he sees in the distance. He sees the elephant of Maharaj Dasharatha, Shatrunjay. He looks, he doesn't see anybody on the elephant. But that doesn't strike him. Just seeing the elephant, he immediately comes on. That wicked Bharat! And after sending you, after conspiring with his mother to send you to the forest, has now come with the entire army to kill you. But O Ram, he doesn't know that I am there to protect him. I will send him to the abode of death and I will take you back to Ayodhya. So at that time, Lord Ram is very calm. He says, oh Lakshman, has Bharat offended you in any way that you are so angry with him? Or is it that in a wave of emotion, you felt that you can come with me to the forest, but now you are finding the forest too austere? And that is why you are wanting to go back to the kingdom? If you want that, then I will tell Bharat and he will stay with me and you can go back and rule the kingdom.
By this, Lakshman is completely mortified. And then,
when actually Bharat comes and he sees Bharat is wearing the robes of ascetic, and then the whole conversation takes place. Lakshman is completely embarrassed, and then the whole event takes place where it's a very elaborate discussion. Bharat, so actually the conversation between Bharat and Ram is like, is said with the conflict between the pinnacle of duty and the pinnacle of love. So Lord Ram is the pinnacle of duty. He's dutifully bound to follow the words of his father. That is his duty. And Bharat is the pinnacle of love. And Bharat is not ready. There's a long discussion that goes to and fro. That will take over an hour to have the whole discussion. But at the end, Bharat says, if you don't come back, then I will sit here and fast to death. And then Lord Ram becomes very grave. And then he smiles. He says, oh Bharat, you wanted me to accept the kingdom? And you had come with the forest for that purpose? I accept your kingdom. Your love has conquered me. And then everybody becomes very happy. Lord Ram stays very grave. I accept your kingdom and I accept your love, O Bharat. But at the same time, in order that our father's words not be falsified, I entrust the kingdom to you for 14 years.
Now Bharat is defeated. So, and then Bharat agrees to go back.
But after seeing this whole loving exchange between Bharat and Lord Ram, then Lakshman feels very, very embarrassed and mortified. And they're almost like a small, he's a younger brother, so sometimes he acts like a small child. So he asks Lord Ram, you know, why is it that I get so angry, O Lord? So why is it that I get so angry? Lord Ram very sweetly replies, he says, oh, Lakshman, you are an emotional person. So there Lakshman asks, are emotions bad? So at that time, Lord Ram says, no. He says, emotions are not at all bad. And emotions are what give beauty to life. But our emotions should be such that they attract us towards dharma and not away from dharma. Certainly we should have emotions, but our emotions should be such that they attract us towards dharma and not away from dharma. So, you know, when suppose a student comes to a hostel, and when he comes to a hostel away from his parents, the whole world of sin is open to him. And he may get attracted to the opposite sex and he may fall for sin. So there are some emotions which are attracting him away from dharma. On the other hand, he may think of his parents and how much they are sacrificing for me. And those emotions will attract him to do his duty. Similarly, when we take initiation, so at that time, you know, we may still be prone to be attracted by sense objects. But then we remember our spiritual master and the vow that we have taken. So the remembrance of the spiritual master and the emotions that we feel for him, they will attract us towards dharma. So we cannot give up emotions. But we can channelize the emotions. We channelize the emotions so that they attract us towards dharma. And that is what the whole concept of rasa is about. So in Asampradaya, Rupa Goswami and then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they are called the Rasika Acharyas. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur wrote the Madhurya Kadambini, which is like a commentary on the Adaushtadha Sadhu Sangha, that verse of the Bhakti Samad Sindhu. And then he also wrote Raghavartma Chandrika, which is like a commentary, sort of, on the Ujjwal Neelamani. So the whole science of how emotions can be developed and channelized for the service of the Lord is talked about in the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya quite extensively. So now, even when we hear the pastimes of the Lord, we can have mundane emotions or we can have divine emotions. The essential tragedy of the modern times is to mistake vasanas to be bhavanas. Now, what is the difference between a vasana and a bhavana? Now, vasana is something which is very external and superficial. Just like sometimes, you know, there are small children and if we tickle their stomach, you tickle their stomach and they'll just start laughing. They're laughing, but are they happy? No, that is not happiness. If that were happiness, and everybody wants to be happy, then, you know, we could just, everybody manufacture perpetual tickling machines and just keep tickling each other and be happy. No, so that is very superficial. Although there is an apparent external expression of happiness, but that is not happiness. That's just something which is biologically triggered and it doesn't touch the heart at all. So similarly, vasanas are actually some things which go outwards and they don't go inwards much. They start from the biology and they could go to the psychology, but they don't go to spirituality at all. So that is vasana. Whereas bhavana, of course, bhavana, emotions can also be spiritual, they can be material. But bhavana is more in the mind. And actually rasa is something which originates from the soul, comes into the mind and then expresses in the body. So when there is male-female attraction, what is there mainly is vasana. It's basically a biological attraction which people give a romantic garb to it. But it doesn't last for very long. So the vasanas are very superficial. The bhavanas, especially when they are in connection with Krishna, they are very deep. So the whole Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu talks about how we can develop our bhavanas for Krishna. That's why, you know, the Hindi translation of ISKCON is Antarashtri Krishna Bhavanamrita Sangha. It's not something Antarashtri Krishna Chetana or something like that. So the word consciousness is Prabhupada's unique rendition of Krishna Rasa Bhavita Matihi. So that how it gets translated. It's very distinctly done. But the point here is that the rasa is experienced in a particular way. That is, when there is a cultured audience to experience that rasa. Nowadays, there are a lot of TV serials which may talk about Ramayana, Mahabharata or Krishna Leela. But when people hear these pastimes, those pastimes often just become another source of entertainment. Now, when people watch a movie, at that time, unconsciously, they identify with the hero. They identify with the hero and they get some enjoyment by, so when the hero and heroine come together, people start whistling. Because basically they imagine, it would be so nice if I would be there and I would be enjoying. So it's all second-hand enjoyment.
Somebody else is enjoying. Somebody else is enjoying and people imagine that we are there.
But the important thing is that when there is a movie, people identify with the hero. They identify with the hero and that's how they get enjoyment. And when we hear Krishna Leela also, we may identify with Krishna. And we may think that I am Krishna and I am so great, I am enjoying. And if that is the case, then that enjoyment is not spiritual. That is still, it is conditioned by the ego and it is still a material form of enjoyment. And we may not even know whether it is material or it is spiritual. But this especially comes out when we hear the conjugal pastimes of Krishna. When we hear the conjugal pastimes of Krishna, if we identify ourselves as the enjoyer, whether in the male body or the female body, if we identify ourselves as the enjoyer, then the conjugal pastimes of Krishna directly trigger our material emotions. And when we hear the childhood pastimes of Krishna, even if our material emotion of caring for our children is triggered, that is still noble. But the Madhura's pastimes often trigger the mundane emotions. And that's why Prabhupada was so careful that we have to hear philosophically the 9 cantos of Bhagavatam. And when we have heard that, we have philosophically understood the position of Krishna. Then when a devotee hears Krishna's pastimes with the gopis, he does not see Krishna as a boy and the gopis as girls. He says Krishna is the Lord and the gopis as devotees. And the devotees identify in that pastime with the gopis. How wonderfully Krishna is reciprocating love with the devotees. And when this mood is there, then the conjugal pastimes of Krishna can also be relished. But without that, often the mood of enjoyment will drag us down rather than dragging us up. So our acharyas have written a lot on the 10th canto. That's why Srila Prabhupada translated the Krishna book, which is a summary study of the 10th canto. So here it is described that sat striyah satpatim yatha, that just as a wife brings a husband under control by her devoted service. So this is also eternal rasa in the spiritual world, the highest, the madhurya rasa. Now Krishna's madhurya rasa pastimes are there in Dwarka, to some extent in Mathura, and also in Vrindavan. So it's interesting that both Lalit Madhav as well as Lalit Madhav is by Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami is Gopal Champu, they describe how the gopis of Vrindavan expand as the queens of Dwarka. And the interesting thing is that according to both acharyas, Radharani expands not as Rukmini but as Satyabhama. And Chandravali expands as Rukmini. So now why is that? Because the relationship between Krishna and the right-wing gopis is Radharani and the left-wing gopis are headed by Chandravali. So Chandravali is always very humble and submissive to Krishna. And Radharani actually controls Krishna. Radharani orders Krishna. Radharani chastises Krishna. So the Ujjwala Neelamani describes that, you know, Chandravali's love for Krishna, it is like Ghrutarasa. Ghrutarasa means it is the taste of ghee. And Radharani's love for Krishna is like Madhurasa. It's the taste of honey. Both are wonderful, ghee and honey, but still honey is more delicious. So, in Dwarka, Krishna is manifesting as the ideal king. And the ideal king needs an ideal queen. And the ideal queen is one who is submissive to the king. And Radharani cannot play that role. Radharani is actually, she controls Krishna. And that's why Chandravali plays that role of Rukmini. And just as we see in the Krishna book, Prabhupada describes how Rukmini never gets angry with Krishna. And Krishna wants Rukmini to get angry, but he never gets angry. On the other hand, Radharani, Satyabhama, the very word Satyabhama means, Satya is nature, Bhama is angry. So, one of angry nature. And sometimes in Lalit Madhav is described how at one time Krishna teases Rukmini and she finally gets angry. And she angrily says, Krishna, what are you doing? And then suddenly she feels hesitant. He says, oh noble husband, oh Arya, please don't do like this. And then Krishna becomes very happy. He says, oh Rukmini, after giving me the flood of nectar by calling me Krishna angrily, why are you giving me this well water by calling me Arya? So he wants to see her angry. But the mood of Chandravali is that, of Rukmini is that she never becomes angry. So Satyabhama, we see she becomes angry. And that anger is also to please Krishna. She becomes angry, but that anger is for pleasing Krishna. So that same relationship between Krishna and the gopis, which is described in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, is elaborated. Shrinath Gopinath Bhagwan ki jai. Shrinath Gopal ji ki jai. Gaurnithai Chandra Bhagwan ki jai. So, the 10th canto, pastimes which are described, are also elaborated further in several books by our acharyas like the Gopal Champu and Anandavan Champu. So, in the Anandavan Champu is described how when Krishna played his flute and all the gopis came. And Krishna told them, so now please, you can go back. You wanted to come, you came and saw this forest, and now you can go back. And the gopis become very annoyed and they say, you know why we have come here. And then they have a very nice discussion. And then, just as the Rasalila is about to perform, Krishna disappears from there. And when Krishna disappears, all the gopis are devastated. Now they look around and then they see that one gopi is missing. And they realize that this one gopi, Krishna has gone with her. And then they start searching around, where is Krishna? The Lord of our hearts is gone. And how can we live without him? They start looking around, calling out for Krishna. And they start speaking in a frantic manner. He says, Krishna is the Lord of our senses and our mind. So our senses and our mind are always with him. So what is the question of separation from him? Our senses and mind have gone with him. Yet who is the wicked person who has created another set of senses and minds which are torturing us so much now? And the gopis become so dazed by thoughts of Krishna that it appears as if they are just like statues who are animated by some ghost within them. They are glazed. And they, in their desperation, they start searching here and there. They ask the peacocks, they ask the tulsi plant, they ask the trees, where is Krishna, where is Krishna? And then they start performing the pastimes of Krishna and trying to somehow alleviate the pain of separation from Krishna. And finally, they perform all the pastimes. And while performing the pastimes, again they come to the pastime of Krishna playing his flute and all the gopis coming and running and Krishna and gopis talking and they perform the rasa. And then suddenly they come to the point where Krishna leaves them and goes away. And that jolts them back to external consciousness. And all the pain of separation that starts burning their bodies. And as they're looking around frantically, suddenly they see that there are the footprints of Krishna. And they look at the footprints and they see, oh, this lotus, it is so cooling. But the weapons that are there, they are actually meant to pierce our heart and gouge our eyes. Where is Krishna gone? They start going after the footprints. And they start searching way, way inside. They see another set of footprints. They understand there's some gopi is there with it. And then finally those footprints also disappear. And they are very bewildered. So at that time, Radharani is with Krishna. And when she's with Krishna, she feels overjoyed. On the other hand, the other gopis are talking. And you know, there is Chandravali's group. So Padma says, she says to Lalita and Vishakha, she says that, you know, you say that Radharani is your leader, but what kind of leader is she? She says that all of you are dear to her, but she has left all of you and gone away alone with Krishna, leaving not only us, but leaving even you to suffer. Actually, her love is only an illusion. So at that time, Shama Sakhi replies, he says that Radharani is like a aquatic plant which is thrown itself into the flowing river of Krishna's love. And therefore she has no control over herself. Whatever Krishna wants, she has to do. Just as a flower grows with its case, but when the flower is to be offered to the Lord, the casing is taken away and the flower is offered. So like that, we are always with Radharani. But when Krishna wants her, if she goes alone, that is no fault of hers. And then they keep searching. And finally, they come to a place where Radharani is also lying, all unconscious. And as she's lying unconscious, they wonder what has happened. So as Radharani is going with Krishna, she remembers. She feels overjoyed on one side to see that she is there with the Lord. But when she thinks of Lalita, Vishakha and other Sakhis, and she thinks that they are all being deprived of the enjoyment of Krishna's association, then she feels very sad. And since she decides that, let me ask Krishna to carry me. If Krishna has to carry me, then he will slow down. If he slow down, and the other Sakhis will be able to catch up with us. So it's sometimes said that Radharani also became proud. Actually, that is only external. Radharani, out of her concern for the other gopis, she told Krishna, carry me. And Krishna also understood the heart of Radharani. But he pretended. Oh, he said, you are feeling tired since this is jungle and we cannot get a palanquin for you. So please climb on my back and I will carry you. He spoke in a harsh voice. And suddenly he disappeared. And as soon as Krishna disappeared, everything that was like nectar for Radharani turned into poison. The beautiful forest night, it seemed to be coming out with sharp arrows and piercing her limbs. The necklaces seemed to have thorns which pierced her body. And she started crying, where is Krishna? Krishna, where are you? And she had this conversation with Krishna. Imagine the conversation with Krishna. So Krishna says, you know, you were proud, so I left you. I don't like pride. He says, no, but it is, I am not proud. I was only concerned about my sakhis. And for their sake, I told you, please, wait and carry me. He says, I don't like such arrogant behavior. He says, oh Krishna, please appear back. If you do not appear back, I will not be able to live. I will die. And you will have to carry my dead body through the forest. So Krishna says that, you know, I left the other sakhis and I am leaving you also. They didn't die and you will also not die. He says, no, they have each other and they will talk with each other and they will remember you. I am all alone. Please, my dear Lord, please come back. You know, if all the other sakhis come here and they see that you have abandoned me like this, then they will censure you. And how will you defend yourself, my dear Lord? And I cannot tolerate you being censured. Even if they don't see me, I will die before that. And if I am dead, the whole world will criticize you. My dear Lord, I cannot tolerate that you be criticized for my sake. Please come back. And she has no response from anywhere. And on one side, Radharani thinks that for a lover who is neglected by the beloved, there is no need for life. But at the same time, she's thinking that if Krishna comes back later and I'm not there to serve him, then what is, then that will not be proper. In fact, when Krishna leaves Vrindavan and goes to Dwarka, and the Vrajvasis are ready to give up their lives. But the only thought that keeps them alive is that Krishna will come back. And it's not that they want to enjoy Krishna. They think that if Krishna comes back, and if Krishna finds that we are not there to serve him, then Krishna will be unhappy. Gopal Champu described that there are constantly letters going on between Dwarka and Vrindavan. So in one letter, Krishna writes that, he writes to Nanda Maharaj, he says, I am such an ungrateful son that although you cared for me throughout my childhood, I left you and went away. The only way I can be forgiven for my offense is if I come back to you. Please forgive me till then. And the Maharaj replies to Krishna that, you know, we are separated from you and we suffer. But we don't mind our suffering. We are separated from you and you suffer because of that, and that causes us suffering. Krishna sends a message to the gopis and he says that, actually, you know, I'm longing for the day when we'll be reunited. And therefore, I have created such beautiful gardens. And I'm watering them personally so that we can perform pastime in the bowers. So the gopis ride back. Yes, we are also made gardens over here and we are watering them. But we pour water on the garden and then our hot tears fall on the same plants and they dry up those plants. We cannot live without you. So Radharani is feeling immense separation from Krishna. And at that time, the only way she can maintain her life is when her sakhi Murcha is unconsciousness. He comes and embraces Radharani. Radharani falls unconscious. And the other sakhis come over there and they see, is this Radharani or is this somebody else? And then she realizes Radharani, they're filled with a mixture of respect, disappointment, anger, envy, to see who is the special sakhi who has been separated from Krishna. And then, who was first singled out by Krishna, then separated from Krishna. And then after that, Radharani tells them what has happened. And they all come to the Yamuna banks. And when they come to Yamuna banks, there they start singing the Gopi Gita. And when they sing the Gopi Gita, eventually, Krishna appears over there. So, Krishna appears and he gives different justification. He says that, actually, you know, I separate myself from my devotees so I can intensify their love for me. If they obtain me easily, then they will not understand. Therefore, I sometimes separate myself. And then, tears come in Krishna's eyes. And he says, actually, this is not for devotees like you. That is external for other devotees. But you have already attained the perfection of love. And I cannot raise your love any higher. And the choked voice Krishna says, Na parayeham. He says, I cannot repay the debt of love that I owe you. Therefore, let your own glorious deeds be the remuneration. So as he says, Vashe kurvanti mam bhaktya. That Krishna was conquered by the love of the gopis. So that's what is spread over here. And we know that same Radha Krishna came in Kali Yuga as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sent their special Senapati Bhakta, Srila Prabhupada. Now when Srila Prabhupada preached all over the world, he was unique in our Gaudi Sampradaya in that he explained how that esoteric pastimes of Radha Krishna become accessible to us. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is expressing separation from Radha Krishna at that time, from Krishna, at that time Prabhupada is talking about preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world. Why? Because the essence of the gopis' love for Krishna is not that they are dancing in the forest with Krishna. The essence of the gopis' love for Krishna is that they are ready to sacrifice everything for Krishna. And you know that pastime when they were ready to offer their own dust and ready to go to hell for the sake of Krishna. So that mood of selfless sacrifice is personified by Srila Prabhupada. Now, for the sake of fulfilling Radha Krishna's desire, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's desire, Srila Prabhupada was not just ready to go to hell, but he literally went to hell. Now, he went from the capital of devotion, Vrindavan, to the capital of degradation. That was New York, the Boweries over there. And the way he preached over there was extraordinary. In the early days of our movement, Prabhupada was all alone. And 1968, he had that severe stroke. He came back to India when he went to America. So he had gone to Canada because he had not yet got a permanent residency in America. So he went to Canada and from there he was coming to America back. So he had to go to Santa Fe. And at that time, because ISKCON did not have so much money, Prabhupada was traveling alone. So he came down to Chicago and he had to transit, take another airport and go from there. So he was all alone. He had his luggage with him. And several flights he had to climb up and climb down. And it was a big crowd. O'Hare is a very big airport. The name of that airport is O'Hare Airport. So when Prabhupada's, Tripurari Maharaj was distributing books over there, he told Tripurari Maharaj, they already have got the name Hare. You tell them to add Krishna. Oh, Hare Krishna Airport. So Tripurari Maharaj was taken aback. He said, Prabhupada, they won't listen to us. Prabhupada, that is not your problem. That is their problem. You go and tell them. So, of course, at that time, there was no book distribution going on over there. So, Prabhupada came all alone. He was climbing down a long flight of stairs and suddenly somebody pushed him. And Prabhupada fell and he rolled down the stairs. His bag went off his hands and his head got bruised and his arms got bruised. And there was no one to come to him. Just people were just rushing on. Nobody cared for this elderly Swami. And Prabhupada was lying down there. And somebody came to lift him up. Prabhupada himself got up. He said, "Swamiji, all right." Prabhupada looked at the flight. It was just a few minutes for his flight, for him to catch his flight. He went and rushed and caught his flight. And then he saw that the wounds on his arms were clotting. They were not serious. He remembered just when he was leaving. When he was leaving Montreal, at that time a reporter asked him, "Swamiji, do you have any difficulties when you preach this mission?" So Prabhupada had replied at the time, "I have no difficulties because Krishna is always with me. Because Krishna is always with me." Now here only, when Mumbai Prabhupada was very sick, at that time one astrologer came to him. I told, "Swamiji, you know why you are so sick?" He said, "Because you have accepted too many disciples and you are getting their karma." So Prabhupada was very grateful. Prabhupada said, "Yes. I came to this world to suffer for the sake of others. I came to this world to suffer for the sake of others." So Prabhupada here is focusing in his Parvottvod on Sadhava Samadarshanaha. That a sadhava sees that the main cause of suffering of people is that they are not attached to Krishna. And out of his attachment to Krishna, he wants to make others attached to Krishna. And Prabhupada has given us this wonderful Krishna consciousness movement in which we can practically perform devotional service by hearing Krishna Katha, by practicing the philosophy, by doing different forms of services, and joyfully advance in Krishna consciousness. And in this way, we can all gradually, not prematurely, gradually come to a level where we can also experience spiritual rasa, where we can experience divine emotions while we are performing, hearing Krishna Katha. And that rasa can also become a fact of life for us. Till that time happens, Prabhupada said, that we will enter into Radha Krishna Lila by preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world. In trying to serve Krishna in a practical way, the rasa that we experience in that is actually the rasa of bhakti. That is accessible to us at our level. In the Gaudiya Sampradaya, before Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, the idea of Sankirtan was that you do Kirtan. Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur expanded that by explaining that even printing books is Sankirtan. Prabhupada expanded that further and everything. All the missionary activities of Krishna consciousness are actually Sankirtan. So whatever we are doing, whether it be doing some DT services, cleaning or preaching or book distribution, all these are the means by which we can develop our relationship with Krishna. And through all these, we experience spiritual rasa. And by experiencing that spiritual rasa, we can get rid of the material vasanas. And the more we can get rid of those material vasanas, the more we become steady in spiritual life. So, once we come to this, as Bhakti Swami says, there's a stage called Sthayi Bhav. Sthayi Bhav means steady attraction. When we come to that stage in our bhakti, then it's almost certain from there that we'll advance and go back home, back to Godhead. So, I'll summarize what I discussed. I started by talking about how Bhagavatam establishes the supreme position of bhakti and the supreme position of Bhagwan Sri Krishna. Then we discussed about how the rasas, the different rasas are talked about in our sampradaya, and it is the education of emotions. How emotions can drag us down or they can lift us up. We discussed from the Ramayana. And how those emotions that can be used to lift us up, that is systematically taught in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And even when we hear Krishna's pastimes, to experience the appropriate rasa, we have to have the appropriate philosophical understanding. We identify not with Krishna, but with the devotees of Krishna. And then we discussed how the gopis experience intense emotions in separation from Krishna. And lastly, we discussed how at our level, the rasa we experience primarily is in our service to Krishna. And through our service to Krishna, which we have got by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, we can all come to Sthayi Bhav and ultimately experience whatever rasa we have, eternally relationship with Krishna. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Tai Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bol. Does anyone have any questions? Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.